Good day. Today is Saturday, 14th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched or listened to this programme, you decide that you like what you've watched and heard, and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, over the last few hours, the situation in the conflict in Iran remains pretty much as it was before, except that there's been two interesting events, or military events, if you wish. There's been reports of a deployment of a Marine force, US Marine force, of 2,500 men to the Gulf area, the Persian Gulf area. And there's been an announcement from the President of the United States that he has carried out a heavy bombardment of Harg Island, and that this bombardment was primarily or was entirely focused on military installations on that island, the actual oil and fuel complex on Harg Island was left undamaged, and this was done basically because of President Trump's generosity to the people of Iran. Anyway, that was, I think, a fair summary of the rather strange true social message that the President of the United States published. Well, there's that development, and as I said, there's the development concerning the deployment of the US Marines, 2,500 men in total. And there is a huge amount of speculation about what this deployment is for. Some are suggesting that it is intended to force the opening of the Strait of Hormuz, as part of some complex ground operation, presumably to capture the Strait of Hormuz from the Iranians and to make it possible for ships to transit through the Strait of Hormuz. And by the way, over the last 24 hours or so, I've seen a report that there are some 1,000 ships basically trapped in the Persian Gulf, unable to exit through the Strait of Hormuz. 200 of these are apparently tankers. That perhaps gives a sense of the sheer scale of the crisis in the Persian Gulf at the moment. And apparently there's large numbers of ships also piling up on the other side of the Strait of Hormuz in the Arabian Sea. They were intended to deliver cargoes to the Persian Gulf states, but they are unable to enter. Some ships are able to transit the Strait of Hormuz, a very few at a time. As I discussed in my program yesterday, these ships are able to transit through the Strait of Hormuz because they have permission to do so from the Iranian authorities. They are tankers that apparently continue to ship oil to China, and they are tankers, one tanker to be precise, which ships has shipped oil to India as well. It is still, for me, a continuing mystery why the US Navy is taking no step to stop or capture these tankers when the United States began a conflict with Venezuela a few months ago. It seems like a much longer time ago today, but a few months ago, the US Navy was busy seizing tankers that were carrying oil from Venezuela, or which were trying to reach Venezuela in order to load up with oil. And there was quite a few incidents of that kind. And there was the incident of the Marinera, the ship, the tanker that tried to escape to Russia, and which was, of course, seized by the US authorities off the coast of Britain. Anyway, I don't know why the US Navy is not doing this on this occasion, why no instructions to that effect have been made. Could it be, this is just pure speculation on my part, that the United States is worried that if it starts to interdict tankers in the Indian Ocean in that way, the Chinese Navy, which is much closer to the scene than it was in relation to Venezuela, you only have to look at a map to see why, that the Chinese Navy might start to interfere, and perhaps the Indian Navy as well. Maybe there's been some decision to try to avoid that kind of escalation, but that's purely a guess on my part. I simply don't know. Anyway, there is some speculation that these 2,500 Marines are intended to force a breaking of the Strait of the siege, of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, and that some elaborate military operation of that sort is in the works. Well, I have to say that as of this moment in time, as of this particular moment in time, I think that using a force of 2,500 men to try to break the siege, the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, even if those men are supported by land-based US Air Force assets and the ships of the US task force in the Arabian Sea, I think this would be an all but impossible task, or at least so it looks to my inexpert eyes. The force is far too small for such an operation. The Iranians, of course, control the northern shores of the Persian Gulf. In many places, the land is rocky and high. They, in other words, the Iranians have control of the high ground. They have drones, the famous Shahed drones, and incidentally many other types of drones as well. And they still have ballistic missiles, and they still have various types of cruise missiles, and they have rockets, unguided rockets in enormous numbers, or so it seems, and they have conventional artillery as well. Deploying a force of 2,500 Marines, or 5,000 Marines, as some say, might eventually be deployed for such an enormous operation, such an enormously complex operation, seems to me to be far too few, and it violates the Powell Doctrine, the doctrine associated with the former US Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and later Secretary of State, Colin Powell, of whom Lawrence Wilkerson, by the way, a major commentator on these events, used to be Chief of Staff. Anyway, it violates the fundamental premise of the Powell Doctrine, that the US only conducts operations of this kind if it has overwhelming force behind it. It seems to me that 2,500 men, 5,000 men, comes nowhere close to constituting an overwhelming force for this sort of operation. Even assuming the armies of friendly states, the Persian Gulf states, for example, which are limited in size and have little in the way of combat experience, especially combat experience for this sort of operation, join in with it. And, well, the same is true of using a force of this sort to try to seize Harg Island. Again, I've discussed this in previous programmes. Harg Island is very close to the coastline of Iran. The Iranians again would be able to use drones and missiles and even conventional artillery to duel with any occupation force that tried to seize Kharg Island. To me, quite honestly, and again, I speak without expert knowledge on this matter, on this kind of matter, the seizure of Kharg Island looks like sending a marine force, 2,500 men or 5,000 men, straight into a trap. Now, I said that I'm inexpert in these matters. One person who most definitely is an expert is Jim Webb, a former US Marine Corps veteran, a person who we have been privileged to host as a guest on the Duran, discussing Ukraine war-related issues, a former national security advisor to Robert Kennedy Jr. at a time when Robert Kennedy Jr. was a presidential candidate, and someone who undoubtedly has a much keener understanding of the military issues than I do. And he has recently made the point that the Marine Corps has recently, over the last 10 years to be precise, undergone a major reorganization. It gave up much of its heavy equipment, its tanks, for example, and it is not configured in the way that it used to be. It's not so much a case of it not being able to seize territory, to land on a beach and to engage with the enemy on the beach, but that as it is now essentially a light force, a light infantry force, or a lighter infantry force, it's less able to consolidate and hold on to the positions that it has captured. And he wonders whether the President of the United States is aware of this fact. And I wonder, by the way, whether the President's War Secretary, Pete Hegseth, whose behaviour, I have to say, I find more and more disturbing by the day, and I am far from the only person here. Anyway, I wonder whether they have understood this properly and internalised it, even though, of course, I have no doubt that they have been given this advice by the military professionals who are trying to advise them. So anyway, there it is. A relatively small force deployed so far, and one which I cannot see how it can fulfill some of the tasks that might be asked of it. And of course, this is the US Navy Marines. A few days ago, we had reports about the 82nd Airborne Division in the United States also being asked to stop exercises and for it to prepare for redeployment, presumably to the Middle East. There's been not much more word about this over the last couple of days, but presumably that deployment will happen. So maybe the total force that could be deployed to this area is around 12,000 men, but it still seems to me too small for the tasks that are being talked about. And again, based on what Jim Webb is saying and what I happen to know about the 82nd Airborne Division, we are talking about light infantry, or relatively light infantry, may be capable of conducting assaults, but perhaps unable to hold their positions for very long. If one is talking about heavy infantry, the people with tanks and armoured vehicles and those sort of things, there's no sign that they're going to be deployed to the region at all. There's no orders, so far as I can see, to deploy them. And my understanding is that it would take many months before they were able to establish themselves convincingly in the Middle East. The logistics chains to support them do not exist for the moment, and they continue to be, such as they, to the extent that they do exist, they continue to be hammered by the Iranians with their drones and with their missiles. So maybe that will come. But if so, then we're talking about a military operation that realistically can only happen months from now. And of course, the big question is what happens to energy prices, what happens to the global economy, to the financial system in the meantime. On that issue, there is an excellent article by Eve Smith in Naked Capitalism debating the risks for the global economy if this whole situation continues for much longer. So anyway, this is what I'm going to say about the military developments at the moment. In all other respects, we continue to have bombing, we continue to have missile strikes by both sides, each across against the other. There are all sorts of very confused reports about damage done to 5 air refueling tankers in an airbase, a US airbase in Saudi Arabia. The Wall Street Journal says that these aircraft suffered damage as a result of an Iranian missile attack. There are other claims that the damage was not very extensive and that these aircraft will be repaired very quickly. Of course, a few days ago, the United States confirmed that one air refueling tanker was lost over Iraq, in Iraqi airspace, and that there were attempts to find the crew, which was believed to have bailed out. There were claims that this was due to a mechanical malfunction or to friendly fire or to various things of that kind. There were other reports that, in fact, this tanker had been shot down by enemy action, in other words, by Iranian enemy action. I'm not going to pretend to know what the truth is. I don't know what the truth is. All I would say is that I remember that before the conflict started, Larry Johnson, on his indispensable blog, Sonar 21, made the point that if the Iranians really were seeking to interfere with American aerial operations against their country, then the best way they could do it would be by targeting the air refueling tankers over Iraq and perhaps in Saudi Arabia, and that they had the long-range weapons, the long-range air defense missiles, or were alleged to have the long-range air defense missiles and the ballistic missiles to enable them to do this. And I remember that article, and I noticed that at least 6 tankers have apparently either been lost or have suffered damage. And of course, that is exactly consistent with the point that Larry Johnson was making. To what extent the damage or loss of these tankers is interfering with American operations against Iran, I am, of course, unable to say. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say about the military situation. Iran continues to be defiant. Its leadership remains intact. There were big public protests in support of the government again in Iran a day or so ago. Some of the leaders of the Islamic Republic, President Pezeshkian and Foreign Minister Araghchi, for example, participated in these protests. The United States has offered large sums of money, $10 million, to anybody who can help the United States track down and kill Iranian political leaders, including Iran's new supreme leader, Mohtada Khamenei. I have to say that I find all this incredibly disturbing. It makes it even more, look even more to me, like a gangster hit trying to take out leaders in this sort of way. It contrasts astonishingly with the Russian avoidance of doing that kind of thing in Ukraine. But as I read in an article in the American Conservative, the United States basically has cast aside all restraints in the way it has conducted this war. It barely makes any attempt any longer, or at least the administration, let's stress it is the administration, certainly not the American people as a whole, who continue to oppose this war. But the administration barely makes any attempt to conceal the way in which it conducts this operation, which I think can be accurately described as lawless. And it makes little attempt sometimes to conceal that what you might call plunder is part of the objectives of some of these operations. The American Conservative article that I spoke about said that the president, Donald Trump, in his conduct of this war, is increasingly behaving like a Roman emperor, like Trajan, for example, or people of that kind, who conduct military conquest as much for the objective of seizing plunder as for any higher cause, and is behaving in ways that would certainly not have been anticipated by the writers of the Constitution, the US Constitution, when they drafted that document. But of course, there's also been a very extraordinary article in the Washington Post, which basically says that international law, as it has existed and as it was largely created after the Second World War by the United States itself, the UN, its charter, all of that are now obsolete, that they should be replaced, that the United States should be elevated to a higher level. I mean, if you read this article, that's practically what it says. Than pretty much every other country, and that actions that the United States should be treated as basically legal, or not basically, should be treated as legal, even if they violate international law, as it has always been understood, which the present attack on Iran, of course, does. Well, I suspect we're going to have a lot more arguments of this kind developing over the next few weeks. In the meantime, even as the fighting in, or rather not the fighting, the bombing and the missile strikes and all of that still continue between Iran and the United States and Israel, the Israelis are now fighting another war in Lebanon against Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been conducting its own rocket and missile strikes against Israel. There's been ground fighting as well. There have been various claims that the Hezbollah fighters have successfully damaged Israeli Merkava tanks. A lot of people, most people, are paying less attention to this battle. And again, I'm not going to say that I am fully up to date with all the details, but I will say this: the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah and Hezbollah's ability to defend itself, and the fact that it is successfully launching rocket and missile strikes at Israel, again, weaken the entire argument that was made at such length before this conflict began, that after the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah in 2024, the organization was practically broken, that it had lost its support amongst the Shia community in Lebanon, that it had lost its defensive ability and would no longer be an effective or reliable ally of Iran. Like many such claims that we've seen over the course of this, of these 2 weeks of fighting, and perhaps it's worth saying that we are now at the start of the third week of this war, like so many claims that we heard about how weak the Iranian government and political system had become, how unpopular within Iran it had become, how fragile that system was. The claims about the fragility of Hezbollah now clearly have been shown to have been overstated. I am going to say that something else that has been exposed, or so it seems to me, as being wildly overstated, is the effectiveness of US air defense systems. Now, this has been an important issue because for the last 3 years, well, basically since the Russians began their aerial campaign against Ukraine in the autumn of October 2022, with the first Russian strikes against Ukraine's energy system. Anyway, we have been hearing from Ukraine an unending cascade about their supposed success in shooting down Russian cruise missiles, Russian ballistic missiles, Russian drones, Russian hypersonic missiles, lots of claims that the Ukrainians have managed to shoot down large numbers of all of these missiles. Whenever the Russians conduct a big missile and drone strike on Ukraine, the Ukrainians publish their own account of the number of missiles and drones that the Russians have launched against Ukraine. They then publish their own numbers for the number of these missile and drones that their air defense system has supposedly successfully shot down. These Ukrainian claims are then repeated entirely uncritically in the Western media, and you get the impression, if you simply follow or accept these claims, that the Ukrainians have been almost entirely successful in parrying Russian attacks, missile and drone attacks upon Ukraine. I have repeatedly pointed out, ever since October 2022, that the realities on the ground tell a completely different story. That it is clear that many more, perhaps most Russian missiles get through, and have always been doing so, that many, perhaps most, Russian drones get through, that there is strong reason to doubt Ukrainian claims to have successfully shot down Russian hypersonic missiles. In fact, I made it perfectly clear that I don't believe the claims that the Ukrainians have successfully shot down Russian hypersonic missiles in any quantity. But, of course, everyone in the West accepts that this is true. The result is that Zelensky has been able to tour the West, tour the United States as well. He has demanded endless supplies of PAC-3 Patriot missile interceptors. The United States has indeed given him large numbers of these interceptors. Germany and European taxpayers have recently been spending huge amounts of money buying PAC-3 interceptors for Zelensky and for Ukraine. And they've been sending their own air defense systems, IRIS-Ts and others, the ASPID system. They've all been sending all of those things to Ukraine, all on the assumption that these Ukrainian claims of success in countering Russian drones and Russian missiles have been true. And yesterday, last night, the Ukrainians were at it again, because the Russians again launched one of their big strikes. They haven't done so for some time, and there's been some questions about why the Russians have not done this, but they did launch a big strike last night, and it was again one of those very, very complex strikes that the Russians have now become extremely adept at. It blended Garand drones, again numbered in their hundreds, of various types, with cruise missiles, KH-101s, launched by Russian strategic bombers, and Kalibr missiles, launched by ships of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, and Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missiles, launched apparently from a ground launcher located in Crimea, and large numbers of Iskander ballistic missiles. So all of these weapons launched against Ukraine last night. And if you believe the Ukrainians, again, of the 490 vehicles, missiles or drones that the Russians launched against Ukraine last night, the Ukrainians managed to shoot down around 460. Again, a success rate of something around 90%. Now, there are huge problems with this. Again, the reality of the situation on the ground tells a completely different story. It's early days, and we're still not getting many reports about the success or failure of this Russian attack, but there are still already reports that in some of the areas around Kiev, and I would stress that the focus of this Russian strike does appear to have been Kiev and various industrial facilities and power generating and transmission facilities located around Kiev. Anyway, there's already been quite a lot of evidence that quite a few of these facilities were indeed hit and badly damaged and perhaps partially or completely destroyed as a result of these Russian strikes. But take a step back and think this through. The Ukrainians have recently said that they are largely out of missiles. Patriot air defense missiles, the number of them has been practically exhausted. The Ukrainians claim that, well, the Ukrainians and the Europeans say that they recently transferred what looks like the final batch of 35 PAC-3 Patriot air defense missile interceptors to Ukraine. Other than that, it seems that the cupboard in Ukraine is mostly bare. They don't have many air defense interceptors. There are also lots of reports, I read them in the American media a short time ago, that the fighter jets, the F-16s and the Mirage 2000s, which, when these Russian missile and drone strikes against Ukraine take place, also are involved in shooting down the drones. Well, there were reports in the American media that because of shortages of air-to-air missiles, because of the need to conserve air-to-air missiles for the US and Israeli air forces so as to use them against Iranian drones conducting attacks across the Middle East, the F-16s and the Mirage 2000s are basically out of air-to-air missiles. So if Ukraine is short of missiles, and bear in mind, if we're talking about Patriots, the rule of thumb is that you use two Patriots to shoot down one incoming missile. If so, 35 means that you would probably be able to shoot down, might be able to shoot down 17 incoming missiles, and the Russians are supposed to have launched 70 missiles altogether last night. Well, given that all of this is so, with what exactly are the Ukrainians shooting down all of these drones and missiles that they say that they have successfully shot down? And well, we've had an awful lot said about Ukrainian anti-drone drones. The Ukrainians have been very adept, as they always are, by the way, at publishing film of these anti-drone drones in operation. The indispensable blogger Events in Ukraine has just done a long piece about these. He has suggested that these are of very limited effectiveness, that they're very difficult to operate and require extremely skilled operators, which is obviously true, by the way, and that they are available only in finite numbers, which of course is also true, and that they are expensive, and that, as with all Ukrainian drones, there is an extraordinary zoo of these anti-drone drones produced by the various artisanal workshops and small companies scattered across Ukraine, and by the way, I suspect Europe, all of them receiving large amounts of money to produce these things, and that there is little commonality between them. Anyway, Events in Ukraine suggests that the effectiveness of these drones is anti-drone drones is greatly overstated, and he points out that since the mid-autumn, Ukrainian commentators, including no less a person than the Ukrainian commander, General Sirski, have been complaining that because the Russian drone operators have now learnt to fly their Garand drones very close to the surface, it has become extraordinarily difficult for the Ukrainian radars and for the Ukrainian drones to defeat them. And of course, that is exactly the complaint that the British Defence Secretary, John Healey, made about the Iranian Shahid drones that are now operating in the Middle East, with John Healy, of course, saying that the Iranians learnt how to operate their Shahid drones in this way from the Russians. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, there's actually good reason to think that on this issue, at least, John Healy is actually telling the truth. So I come back to this question. If Ukraine is short of air defense weapons, and if the Russian drones have now learned to evade Ukraine's anti-drone drones, which are probably of limited effectiveness anyway, how can Ukraine continue to make claims that it is shooting down all of these Russian missiles and drones? And why do we see always after every strike evidence that these Russian missile and drone attacks are inflicting such substantial damage? Just saying. Well, the answer surely has now been provided by the experience of the Middle East, because we see that, again, despite claims there, in this much more publicly conducted battle, US and Israeli air defense systems, which of course include Patriots and TADs and various other types of missile, Iron Domes and David Sling and all of that, they have proved of only limited effectiveness against incoming Iranian missiles and drones. And, well, I think that this is hardly controversial anymore. And I come back to my point. Surely this demonstrates, proves, if you like, that these Ukrainian claims of such enormous success in shooting down Russian missiles and drones are wrong. One person who seems to think this, by the way, is none other than the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Because over the last couple of days, President Zelensky, as he always does, never missing an opportunity for some successful commercial enterprise, has been telling everybody that Ukraine is ready and able to provide the Gulf states and indeed the United States with effective anti-drone technology to defeat the Iranian drones. And there are claims that he's managed to sign deals with the Saudis and with other Gulf states for the Ukrainians to come and to provide their training and technology to these countries to repel these Iranian drone attacks, which, by the way, to my mind, simply proves, goes to prove, that whenever somebody wants to come up with some kind of, shall we say, inventive proposal of this kind, well, there is always a sucker there who's prepared to put up the money. Anyway, Donald Trump is completely unimpressed. He's already very angry with Zelensky, as he's made fairly clear, for depleting US arsenals of air defense weapons. And he's made it absolutely clear that the United States, at least, is not interested in any of this Ukrainian drone technology, that the United States has its own anti-drone drones, which operate with some degree of AI technology. I suspect they will be as ineffectual as the Ukrainian ones are, by the way, just saying. But anyway, he is not interested in these offers that Zelensky is making. Well, anyway, there it is. Air defence in the Middle East has proved perhaps not a total failure, but a significant failure. Air defence in Ukraine, it's the same. These events that we have seen over the last 2 weeks, I think, have vindicated to a great degree Ted Postol's claim, Professor Postol's claim, that the whole narrative of successful interception of ballistic missiles is a piece of mythology spread by the air defence industry and by self-interested people like President Zelensky. At least this is true in the West. Anyway, that's now brings me to the situation in Ukraine itself. And, well, here, perhaps the most interesting thing is the increasing tension that there now is between the United States and its European allies. The Europeans are very unhappy about the American decision to loosen sanctions on the Russian oil trade. They've actually said as much. And already you are starting to see complaints starting to circulate in Europe that the situation with weapons supplies to Ukraine is now becoming, well, critical. That American weapons supplies effectively are not coming to Ukraine. That the current elevated energy prices are strengthening Russia's fiscal position, which is true, and that Vladimir Putin and Russia are the big winners so far of the crisis in the Middle East. Now, I think that there is only a certain amount of truth to this. I doubt very much that if you go to the Kremlin, you will find the tough-minded officials there fully agreeing with this view and saying that we need to keep the war in Ukraine, in Iran, continuing for weeks and months ahead, because that strengthens our own position in Ukraine. And of course, it strengthens our own fiscal position, that because we're getting all of these oil receipts, that puts us in a position where we can continue to fund the war. Of course, saying those things are true in themselves. The Russians do have more money, $2 or $3 billion more, or their equivalent, each month from the current high oil prices remain in effect. And as I said, if this continues for several months, then that will make an actual difference to the state of the Russian budget. It will move from deficit into surplus, and at some point the Russians would probably be able to cover the deficit for their 2025 budget as well. There was a lot of talk in the media in the West a few weeks ago before the conflict started about how the Russian authorities were considering cutbacks in public spending because of, in order to plug holes in the budget deficit. That is true, by the way, but of course cutting public spending in order to plug holes in a deficit is something that all governments have to do at some time, at some point or other. The big exception is the United States, which adds more to its deficit every year, but which, because the United States still has the world's reserve currency, isn't perhaps the immediate pressing problem for the United States that it should be. But if we go back to Russia, the fact that the Russians can cut public spending to a certain extent, the fact that the Russians have raised VAT, none of this points to a fiscal crisis in Russia, and it shouldn't be construed in that way. And as I have said in program after program, the major cause for these deficits and for the slowdown in the Russian economy that we have been seeing is not the Western sanctions or the gyrations in the oil market. It has been the very high interest, the very tough monetary policy insisted upon by the Russian Central Bank with the full backing of President Putin himself in order to bring inflation down from the high levels it reached as a result of the overheating of the economy that we saw in 2024. And of course, the Russian Central Bank always takes this to the extreme. They raise interest rates much higher than central banks in the West would ever dream of doing. And they keep interest rates at these very high levels for much longer than would be tolerable or acceptable in the West. And that is exactly what we have seen in Russia. And these very high interest rates, about which you never read, by the way, in the Western media anymore, are having the completely predictable drag effect on the Russian economy, even as inflation continues to fall. But anyway, I've discussed all of this so many times. It's tiresome, as I said, to repeat all of these points again and again. Whatever happens in the Russian economy, always some people in the West will come back and will say that it is due to sanctions. They will say that Russia is running out of money, that the economy is about to implode, that all it needs is a little bit more pressure for a little bit more, for a bit longer. And everything that we said would happen back in February 2022, when we first imposed the sanctions, will finally happen. Anyway, I'm not going to devote more time to this. But anyway, returning to these topics, it is certainly true that the Russians have, in the short term, achieved some benefit from this war. It is true that Ukraine's forces, already very run down and depleted, are going to be even more short of weapons and munitions and artillery shells than they already were. And it is also true that Russia's budget and fiscal position is going to become stronger over the course of this year and perhaps even next year, depending on how long this position with high energy costs continues for. But to come back to what I've been saying previously, it is simply not the case that the Russians have wanted this war to happen or that they are looking for ways to prolong it. In fact, there's a report today in Axios that Vladimir Putin actually proposed to Donald Trump that an agreement be reached. I suspect this was references a discussion that took place before the war, that an agreement be reached whereby Iran's enriched uranium be transferred to Russia, where there are extensive uranium storage facilities, all as part of some sort of agreement that could be put together to allay American concerns about Iran's nuclear enrichment program, to put concerns, worries about Iran developing a nuclear weapon, to put those concerns once and for all to an end and to avoid the war. And in the conversation that Putin had with Trump on the phone a few days ago, we know from Ushakov's briefing that the Russians again, Putin again, floated ideas for bringing the war to an end, for negotiating some kind of arrangement between the United States and Iran, which would enable Donald Trump and the United States to pull back from the war. So none of this is consistent with the Russians saying to themselves, well, how do we sort out our financial problems, our fiscal problems? How do we further weaken Ukraine? Let's lure the Americans into an extended conflict in the Middle East that will stop American weapons supplies to Ukraine, and it will also enable us to plug the hole in our budget. Now, what that also means is that whatever advantages the Russians are gaining from this war, they feel would be offset by the risks. By the risks of an escalation, by the risks of the United States and Israel perhaps doing something that would be very extreme and which might create a massive crisis in an area region close to Russia's southern borders, that might create a deeper crisis in the Middle East, which could put the entire OPEC plus arrangement in jeopardy, that the Russians far-sightedly see all this, worry about all of this, and say to themselves that any short-term benefits are really not worth the enormous risks that this conflict presents. What all this shows is the sharp contrast between the way the two governments, the ones in Washington and Moscow, go about their business. One, the government in Moscow, is methodical, risk-averse, cautious, prizes stability and predictability, is careful always to keep its own financial house in order. To repeat again, a budget deficit is not a fiscal crisis, especially not in a country like Russia, which is self-sufficient in food and raw materials and which has a debt to GDP ratio below 20%, just saying, and which a country which is able to look forward to the future says to itself that the situation in Ukraine, for example, really does not require dramatic cutoffs of American weapon supplies. The Ukrainian army was already short of men and already short of supplies. The Russian army was already growing in size and abundantly provided with supplies. The risks out of proportion to the potential benefits. It's more important to look at the long term than think about what advantage you can achieve short term. Whereas the United States, I would suggest, is exactly the opposite. And this is true of every US administration that I know. Perhaps this one, the current one, has taken this to an extreme. A government that is addicted to risk, that looks constantly for short-term solutions, that barely strategizes in any meaningful sense. I don't mean the various plans and ideas that the neocons come up with, because to my mind, these are not really consistent with proper long-term strategy, but which treats everything instead as some kind of complex game of chess in which you achieve a quick outcome and walk away and call yourself the winner. A government that really isn't capable of planning ahead, as we are seeing currently in this war. And I'm going to suggest that we see the same pattern in the kind of missile and drone strikes and bombing attacks that the Russians carry out in Ukraine and that the Americans carry out in Iran. Russian missile drone strikes, part of what is clearly a very careful and very carefully thought through and structured plan, agreed well in advance, intended to assist the military to achieve its military objectives in the battle, on the battlefield, with those objectives always being focused on achieving the wider political objectives as well. Whereas the American plan, as far as I can tell, in Iran is to bomb whatever can be bombed. Harg Island currently, northern Tehran in many cases, hunting down Iranian leaders, a lot of it done for the media cycle, the news cycle, without really being thought through to any very great extent. Now, on the subject of Harg Island, by the way, I would just quickly say that if you follow an article that Larry Johnson has written for Sonar 21, it seems that Harg Island's importance to Iran's oil export industry has anyway been overstated, that the days when 90% or was it 80% of Iran's oil exports were exported through Harg Island might be in the past, that the Iranians have developed various alternative oil export facilities, that its loss would not be the crippling blow to the Iranian oil industry that many people in the West, and perhaps some people in Iran itself, actually believe. Just say. Well, contrast that with the Russian drive to disconnect Ukraine's energy system, which clearly is planned over time to degrade Ukraine's industrial and financial system, and also to degrade Ukraine's ability to sustain the war on the battlefields. Anyway, I've discussed all of this at length. I'm not going to say more. I'm now going to turn very quickly and very briefly to military developments in the conflict in Ukraine. Now, we have done, and it has now been published on the Duran, a programme on the military situation in Ukraine. And over the course of it, we were privileged, Alex and I, to interview Stanislav Krapivnik, who is, of course, in regular contact with people within the Russian military. And, well, there is little doubt. I see this myself in various reports now. The Russian confidence is growing, and that the Russians do feel that the initiative is firmly in their hands. The Ukrainian offensive in Zaporozhye has been discussed at length now in another big article in Redovka. I noticed that this article in Redovka described an almost identical situation to the one previously described by Scott of Calibrated, whom I consider to be, by a significant distance, the best and most thoughtful mapper of the battlefield. The Ukrainians have been unable in Zaporozhye, northern Zaporozhye, to capture or hold any particular ground. There is a large grey zone. There are Ukrainian troops who are able to move around in the steppe lands of southern Ukraine, avoiding contact with Russian units. But the Russians are stably anchored in the various villages and settlements that they control. And clearly what they're doing is they're waiting for the conclusion of the thaw, the Rasputitsa period, at which point they will conduct a sweep and they will clear out these Ukrainian positions in northern Zaporozhye. And in the meantime, the Russians continue their operations in places like Konstantinovka, in close to the town of Dobropilia, and perhaps most pressingly and importantly, in the area north and northeast of Slavyansk, where the Russians seem to be working steadily to capture all of the high ground around Slavyansk through the capture places like Rai Alexandrovka, Liman eventually, Sviatigorsk, another town in this area, where the Russians are now present, and positioning the Russians so that they can establish that cauldron around the cities, the towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, that Russian commentators have increasingly been talking about. And Stanislav said that the view in Moscow is that, contrary to what were the expectations in Ukraine, this year's thaw, the Rasputitsa, would be relatively short. Despite the heavy snow that fell in January and February, summer temperatures have been very high. A lot of the water, the groundwater, is evaporating. The ground is hardening fast, and it will be probably hard enough for the Russians to move earlier in April, perhaps even in late March, well before the Ukrainians perhaps are anticipating. And Stanislav also made a very interesting point about these Russian operations in northeastern Ukraine, which I acknowledge up to now I have not really been able to understand. Stanislav pointed to the success the Russians have recently been achieving in Sumy region. The fact that they have captured several positions north of Sumy itself, that they're now entering a large forested area to the north of Sumy. Some commentators, especially last year, speculated that this forested area would be a protection for the city of Sumy from a Russian attack. In fact, the reality appears to be the exact opposite. The forest provides the Russians with cover so that they can bring troops very close to the city of Sumy in preparation for an attack on that city. And the key thing is that Sumy itself, a city rather than a town, its population is around 250,000 people, but apparently a town relatively difficult for the Ukrainians to defend. And by the way, on that point, I should add that when the Russian army entered Ukraine in February 2022, on the first day, they actually entered the city of Sumy unopposed, and they held it. They were in control of Sumy for a period of roughly 24 hours. Instead of consolidating and holding on to Sumy, which perhaps might have been the correct thing to do, the Russian units that occupied Sumy on the first day, on the 24th and 25th of February 2022, however, then advanced to Kiev. They were never enough of them to be able to hold on to Sumy and to advance on Kiev as well. I've discussed this whole operation around Kiev in February, March 2022. My own view, and I think that this is well established now, is that the Russian force that was concentrated around Kiev over the first few weeks of the special military operation was never more than 25,000 men in total, which would have been entirely insufficient to capture Kiev against any level of organized resistance, as the Russians, of course, must have known. Anyway, the point is that the Russians this time are much closer to Kiev, to Sumy, are very close to Sumy. If they capture it this time, it will be different from what was the case in 2022. This time, they will be able to hold it. And if the Russians capture Sumy, and we aren't yet sure that this is their plan, but the Russian commander of Group of Forces North, General Nikiforov, has at times spoken as if it is the long-term plan, then this will be, of course, the capture of a regional centre. Sumy is the centre of Sumy region, the capital of Sumy region. But according to Stanislav, and he knows the topography here very well, the Russians will be in control of a key city through which many of the major roads and railways passed, and which is a critical supply route for the city of Kharkiv. The big prize in northeastern Ukraine. And what Stanislav didn't discuss is the movements of Russian forces in Kharkiv. The Russians have been steadily, though very incrementally, expanding what they call their buffer zone in Kharkiv region. And of course, in Volchansk and in the nearby village of Lipsy, they are relatively close to Kharkiv city already from the north. But of course, the Russians are also positioned to the south of the city of Kharkiv, in the Kupiansk area. Notice that we haven't been hearing anything about the situation in Kupiansk for some time, given that much of the information about the war comes from Ukrainian sources, and given that the Ukrainians were at one time claiming all kinds of successful offensive operations in Kupiansk, we can, I think, safely assume that the Ukrainian offensive in Kupiansk, such as it was, has ended. All of the latest information was of the Russians consolidating and clearing Ukrainian positions on the east bank of the Oskol. Well, once the Russians have consolidated control of Kupiansk and of this whole area and cleared the Ukrainians from there, control of Sumy, the city of Sumy in the north, and control of Kupiansk, quite apart from the bearing, what bearing it might have in terms of Russian operations in Donbass. Anyway, these operations would prepare the ground for a siege of the city of Kharkiv, just as Russian operations in Zaporozhye region, the Russian moves to capture the town of Orekhov, and beyond that, the city of Zaporozhye itself, and to reach the Dnieper, potentially open the way for an advance to Odessa as well. Here one can see a clear operational plan starting to take shape against an enormous country. Ukrainian territory is enormous. Conquering a country of that size, of course, presents huge challenges. But we see the systematic and methodical way in which the Russians have addressed them. And of course, it may be that the Americans are lucky in Iran, that there's going to be a political crisis there, that the government is indeed going to collapse, that some personality in Iran will take control and will lead Iran in a more pro-American direction, or that the country disintegrates and fragments, something of that kind. But in the absence of that, and in the absence of regime change in Iran, we could see that the Americans don't seem to have a plan for what in the end they're going to do. Well, anyway, that's my take of the situation today. I'm going to guess that at least for the next few weeks, the conflict with Iran is going to metastasize into a long war, an attrition war, if you like. And probably that is going to affect my coverage. And it may be that I'm going to return to more Ukraine-related matters, because I suspect that in the next few weeks, we're going to start to see events in Ukraine itself begin to take shape and develop more quickly and more fast. But anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Don't forget also to check out our Substack site. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.